Okay, so why don't we read that again and then we can start from there.
Vincent, would you like to start?
Can you hear me now? Hello?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. To suppose otherwise would be to suppose that the spirit which now presides over the human soul experience was originally formed by a human mentality in the human body, exists by that, and cannot exist apart from it, cannot ever go below or above it. In fact, it would then be reasonable to suppose that it is not immortal, but has come into existence by the appearance of the human mind and body in the evolution, and would disappear by their disappearance. But body and mind are not the creators of the spirit. The spirit is the creator of the mind and body. It develops these principles out of its being. It is not developed into being out of them. It is not a compound of their elements or a resultant of their meeting. If it appears to evolve out of mind and body, that is because it gradually manifests itself in them, and not because it is created by them or exists by them as it manifests. They are revealed as subordinate terms of its being and are to be finally taken up out of their present imperfection and transformed into visible forms and instruments of the spirit. Our conception of the spirit is of something which is not constituted by name and form, but assumes various forms of body and mind according to the various manifestations of its soul being. This it does here by a successive evolution. It evolves successive forms in successive strata of consciousness. For it is not bound always to assume one form and no other, or to possess one kind of mentality, which is its sole possible subjective manifestation. The soul is not bound by the formula of mental humanity. It did not begin with that and will not end with it. It had a prehuman past. It has a superhuman future.
Yeah, so we had finished that paragraph before, and that is to say that Sri Aurobindo is telling us there that the inhabitant in the forms of nature is not dependent on those forms of nature, yet that it is intimately related to those forms in nature, because in a way the evolution of that spirit within has to do with its gradual mastery of these forms and eventual ability to transform these forms and, in a sense, create its own forms. To recognize that the forms given to the soul are forms of materialization of its own self-expression. So that recognition becomes the transition point from the sleep of Purusha to its self-awakening, to its self-possession, or to its possession of Prakriti as an aspect and form of itself. Now this takes place through this process of evolution that Sri Aurobindo has outlined here, going the and you know, as he points out, there are two lines of evolution: the evolution of spirit or evolution of soul and the evolution of nature. Evolution of nature is producing these bodies And by bodies, we don't mean just physical bodies, but all the koshas, the habitations in which the inhabitant will live. And these bodies are, so to say, related to archetypal poises of Prakriti and of Purusha. But these poises of Purusha are archetypal poises of Purusha. But the soul is moving through a journey in which it occupies these particular poises as stations of its own self-expression and its own growth. But it is not either conditioned or it is not formed by these nature bodies. So that's the reason why the soul in us, as in the case of any other formation, is ultimately free of the nature vestments, as he says, that it assumes. We are human today, but the soul in us has had pre-human lives or births or poises and will have superhuman futures. So that's the point that Sri Aurobindo is making over here. It's a very critical point in his argument, because he has moved from actually arguing for the existence of a soul which is born repeatedly and is related to the evolution of the universe, the evolution of consciousness in the universe in an individual form. And that argument has been brought round right now to the point where he is claiming that that evolution ultimately results in the discovery by that soul of its own nature habitations to be nothing other than its self-expression. So when that happens, this cycle of the what we call the ignorance, the avidya, passes into another phase, the cycle of vidya, where the soul and nature equation is transformed, and we have what one might call the combined action of the Ishvara Shakti through the, you know, agency of soul and nature.
Devashishda.
Yes.
So to be able to say this with quote-unquote certainty, right? To be able to watch these lines of evolution, these dual lines of evolution of the spirit as well as of Prakriti, then the consciousness has to get to a point where it's outside of the evolution. Would that be correct?
Yeah. In a sense, what he is telling you is that there is a part, and as he has developed the argument in this chapter itself, if you remember, he has pointed out to the dual element of the spiritual person, okay, and he's talking about that, you know, the evolution of consciousness is taking place through something which is in us, which is free of nature, okay, so that is the first point of independence. But then that which is free of nature is still bound to the evolutionary movement. And that is the reason why he is arguing that the soul is not a capricious wanderer from world to world, but undergoes this long succession of rebirths in keeping with the evolution of universal nature. But at the same time, he's saying that there is another aspect to us which is free of the evolutionary movement. Okay, so that is about two paragraphs before where we are right now, where he has talked about that this fact, the human birth in this world is on its spiritual side a complex of two elements, a spiritual person and a soul of personality. The former is man's eternal being, the latter is his cosmic and mutable being. So in a way, this entire description is paralleling or taking its sort of, you know, stand in the Isha Upanishad's idea of the non-birth and the birth. If you remember, in the Isha Upanishad, it is being said that there are two statuses or poises of being, the non-birth and the birth, and that the consequence of consciousness in each is different. Through one, one can know one's evolutionary and temporal being, and through the other, one can know one's immortal being. Okay, so these are the two particular poises: a temporal eternity and a eternity outside of time, an atemporal eternity. So what you're saying is quite true, in that to get a true view of these cycles of evolution, one must, in a sense, have this kind of a sweeping view that looks from above at the entire range of evolutionary becomings of soul and as well as nature.
Yeah, thank you, Abhishek. And the psychic being itself is not that position, is it? Or will that be in the supermind? Or even when we go to the psychic being, we are already in that position?
No, the psychic being, it's a very good question. Actually, it's a very profound question. The psychic being is the evolutionary soul, the soul in time. That is the part in us which is bound, as it were, to the movement of evolution in nature. Now, bound is a word that is, you know, not to be understood in terms of the ego's bondage. So it is free even while it is bound. You see, nevertheless, it is bound because it has chosen to undergo that series of sort of steps. And you're very right in that it is when it enters into the nature body and the Purusha Shakti equation of supermind, it is only then that, as I said, the cycle of avidya comes to an end. And it can see in terms of the entire progression from above. But at the same time, it is part of the psychic experience to feel or to know its own temporal eternity. In other words, the psychic being knows distinctly that it has assumed other births in the past, and it will assume other births in the future. This knowledge is already there in the psychic being. But the totality of the knowledge, the integrality of that knowledge is in the supermind.
Yeah, very nice. Thank you, Devashita.
So would you say that the soul itself, the in non-birth, is what Sri Aurobindo calls the psychic entity?
The soul in what? Can you repeat that question, Anjali?
The soul in non-birth, that which is not in birth, is the psychic entity?
No. The psychic entity is already the soul in birth. But the soul in non-birth is the Jivatman. The soul in non-birth is that which has not entered, is not imminent, not entered time and space and the universal evolution, but guides it from outside. That is the Jivatman. But the psychic entity is the soul portion or the soul poise within the evolution. The psychic being is a soul personality which is developed by the psychic entity in its evolution as it moves from nature body to nature body. In other words, it is assuming its nature bodies and becoming more and more master of these nature attributes or qualities or gunas.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yeah, let's go.
Monica, did you want to read? Louise, do you want to read?
Yes, I will read.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So. What we see of nature and of human nature justifies this view of birth of the individual soul from form to form until it reaches the human level of manifested consciousness, which is its instrument for rising to yet higher levels. We see that nature develops from stage to stage, and in each stage takes up its past and transforms it into stuff of its new development. We see too that human nature is of the same make. All the earth past is there in it. It has an element of matter taken up by life, an element of life taken up by mind, an element of mind which is taken up by spirit. The animal is still present in its humanity. The very nature of the human being presupposes a material and a vital stage which prepared his emergence into mind, and an animal past which molded a first element of his complex humanity. And let us not say that this is because material nature developed by evolution of his life and his body and his animal mind, and only afterwards did a soul descend into the form so created. There is a certain truth behind this idea, but not the truth which that formula would suggest, for that supposes a gulf between soul and body, between soul and life, between soul and mind, which does not exist. There is no body without soul, no body that is not itself a form of soul. Matter itself is substance and power of spirit, and could not exist if it were anything else, for nothing can exist which is not substance and power of Brahman. And if matter, then still more clearly and certainly life and mind be that, and ensouled by the presence of the spirit. If matter and life had not already been ensouled, man could not have appeared, or only as an intervention or an accident, nor as a part of the evolutionary order.
So, here Sri Aurobindo is pointing to the fact that soul and nature have been inextricably together from the very beginning. That, in a sense, you can talk about sort of nature evolving and soul evolving, but the two are not separate. The two have been constantly and intimately tied to one another. And he brings this to the front by talking about the evolution of nature leading up to the human being. The fact that human nature is clearly an evolution in which there is properties of matter and life that have been raised to a certain form. Now, this in itself is something very inviting, because we realize that when we talk about evolution, normally biological evolution restricts itself or limits itself to just the evolution of forms and their relationship with functions. Function, survival, and form. That is where it draws its bottom line. But there is more than that to even the nature and the evolution of nature. There is consciousness evolving in nature itself. So that has to do with the properties of animal nature, for example, plant nature, animal nature, and the properties of human nature, properties of mentality and vitality, which are present in the human being and which show an assumption of such properties from prior stages in nature itself. Leave alone the evolution of the psychic entity or the psychic being. So the question as to whether this evolution of nature and its consciousness is something independent, and what we call soul only enters into the human being, is what he raises over here. And here again he is developing this idea, because he is answering a number of questions. He starts with answering the questions of modern materialist understanding of reality, but now he is going into various kinds of occult explanations of reality that he is also addressing by this kind of analysis. So what he is saying over here is that there is a certain truth to the fact that there is a kind of special entry into the human being that takes place. And that truth is of the nature of something pre-existent, an archetype, a human archetype, you may say, the human type of being, that makes its entry into the human being as the psychic being. So these things have higher archetypal existences, but at the same time they also have lower evolutionary existences. So there are two things going on. Just as in the case of the avatar, there is a higher supreme being that enters into nature by assuming a psychic being that has evolved through time at the normal human level of reality as well. It is a psychic being that assumes the psychic entity's evolution at a certain point in time when the human nature is manifest. So actually it is just about the time of the coming of mind in the mother's telling, just nascent to the coming of mind, that the psychic being makes its entry into the stage of the evolution of soul. And on the other hand, in the evolution of nature, mind makes its entry. Now, this intimate relationship is nevertheless something which does not begin at the human level, and that's the point he's making. It begins from the very beginning of time in the evolutionary universe. So we find that whether matter or life, whatever universal principle of nature is making its expression, these are various self-expressions of spirit, and soul is an individualized form of the same spirit which is there to experience these as its own self-expressions. Firstly, in individualized and partial forms, but ultimately in total universal forms. The whole of matter, the whole of life, the whole of mind, is nothing but a self-expression of the Supreme Spirit as the Supreme Soul, Purushottama, and therefore can be realized to be such by each self-concentration of Purushottama as every individual psychic being.
Could you repeat that portion where you gave the analogy to the avatar? Where you said you were saying that at the onset of the mind, that's when the psychic entity or the psychic being enters the evolution, just as in the case of the avatar, there is the divine reality behind that has entered a formed psychic being. Is that, would that?
Yeah, not the psychic entity, but the psychic being assumes the evolution of the psychic entity. You see, this is if you read between the lines, the question arises, Sri Aurobindo is talking about the fact that psychic evolution, evolution of soul, is not something which makes its beginning with the appearance of mind on the stage of nature. That is what is, that is in sum the gist of this paragraph. But in saying that, he says, and let us not say that this is because material nature developed by evolution his life and his body and his animal mind, and only afterwards did the soul descend into the form so created, colon. Mm-hmm. There is a certain truth behind this idea, but not the truth which that formula would suggest. So this, you know, sideline that he introduces is what I'm trying to develop by saying what I said. In other words, what is the truth in that idea? The truth which is not what the formula suggests. Well, the truth in the idea is that there are archetypal realities above in supermind which make their interventionist entry into nature. In other words, they enter abruptly at a certain point in time.
So those are the avatars.
Like,
sorry.
Just like the avatar makes its interventionist entry into nature at certain points in time, the avatar make these entries by preparing from above a certain soul, first a certain psychic entity and then a psychic being through a number of rebirths until it is ready for the avatar to assume it. But in a general sense, every psychic entity is a certain kind of evolutionary product of the Supreme Purushottama moving towards a certain point of time in its development or evolution. And at that point, psychic being makes its intervention in the same way in which avatar makes its intervention in the psychic being. Okay? So that is the reason why he says that particular thing that he says there. There is a certain truth behind this idea, a truth behind the idea that soul descends into the form so created. But it is not the same as the formula, because soul does not descend without any preparation. The soul has been in preparation through the evolution of the psychic being. So basically, it is only a vantage of perception. If we look at it from below, then it is always in evolution, and at a certain point, it makes its appearance. If we look at it from above, then it is being made to evolve, and at a certain point it makes its appearance.
Actually, could you tell us what is the misconception that would lead that it would lead to, which he's asking us to avoid here? I mean, I didn't understand that. It seems that he's taking care to suggest a certain line of thought as against another line, but I didn't understand what that other line is.
Yeah, the line is, the misconception he is asking us to guard against is that human soul, call it psychic being or call it, you know, soul personality, makes its appearance with the human being only after a certain evolution of nature has taken place.
Okay.
Now this is, you see, for example, if you were to say only human beings have souls, this is the thing that he is trying to make us guard against.
Okay.
Human beings are not the only entities in nature that have souls. Soul exists from the very beginning in nature, and matter itself is inhabited by soul. It is only at the human level that a certain kind of formation of soul takes place and makes its entry. That is what we call the psychic being. So that is the truth in that formula.
Okay.
But the misconception is that there is no soul before the human being. That is what he's asking us to guard against.
Okay.
Evolution of soul is as central to this universe as evolution of nature. This is the point he's trying to emphasize.
Is it true that the only difference is that it is in human birth that the soul actually enters into the form? And before that, it stands behind the form.
No, you mean the psychic being, but psychic entity is present inside the form. Psychic entity, the psychic spirit is present right from the stage of matter. What you're talking about behind and entering into has more to do with the emergence of the psychic being. But the soul as such is present, and that's what he's saying, it is present all the way right from matter. It is making its gradual emergence, and it's only in the human being that it fully makes its emergence in a kind of personality, and that is the psychic being.
Thank you.
So, talking of form and function, is there also an evolution of function going on, or is it only an evolution of form?
You mean evolution of function going on at what level? At the level of matter, so, or at the level of consciousness?
I guess first at the level of, I mean, even at the level of, say, the very... the ordinary biological evolution.
Yeah, ordinary biological evolution, definitely evolution of function is going on, because whole idea of biological evolution is that forms are evolving functions which adapt, which allow them to adapt better and become more sort of, you know, survive better as a species. So, evolution of forms is really an evolution of functions as far as biological evolution goes. But as far as the evolution of consciousness goes,
yeah,
it is not so much an evolution of functions, because it is not tied to survival, but it is an evolution of self-mastery and identity with nature. How consciousness overcomes the unconscious element and becomes its master, ultimately to the degree of transfiguring it to a perfect expression of its divinity. That is the evolution of consciousness. But the evolution of form is purely how can forms function better so that they can survive as a species, you know, in better and better ways.
Yeah, very nice. So when we say the mastery over X, that X itself is, I guess what I was trying to ask was is that X itself a constant, or that mastery over something, that something itself is because of the field of consciousness changing as the evolution goes on?
Yeah, undoubtedly. That, that mastery over X is itself a certain kind of changing reality. That X is nature, basically.
Yeah.
And nature itself is evolving, it's changing, it's providing new conditions for mastery and self-expression. And it is, you know, this whole discussion again relates to the Aitareya Upanishad and the marshalling of bodies before the gods. And ultimately the God saying that only when the human appears, it says, oh, truly well-formed, and that becomes the habitation in which they enter. So that is to say that it is only at the human level that the possibility of the Purushottama's self-expression as Purusha and Prakriti is latently available. See, it's still not available, hardly so. But the beginnings of full self-consciousness make their appearance, because ultimately mind is a derivative form of supermind.
See, beautiful.
Mind is nothing else but a self-veiling of supramental prajna.
Yeah, very nice, Devashishtha. Thank you. So, shall we go to the next paragraph?
Yeah, let's try to.
Luis, do you want to read?
Sure, but I just want to make sure, is it that we arrive then necessarily? Is that the start of that paragraph?
Yeah.
It took me a couple of paragraphs to find it.
Yeah, that's right.
Is that correct? Okay. We arrive then necessarily at this conclusion that human birth is a term at which the soul must arrive in a long succession of rebirths, and that it has had for its previous and preparatory terms in the succession of the lower forms of life upon earth. It has passed through the whole chain that life has strung in the physical universe on the basis of the body, the physical principle. Then the farther question arises whether humanity, once attained, the succession of rebirths will still continues, and if so, how, by what series, or by what alternations. And first, we have to ask whether the soul, having once arrived at humanity, can go back to the animal life and body, a retrogression which the old popular theories of transmigration have supposed to be an ordinary movement. It seems impossible that it should go back with any entirety, and for this reason that the transit from animal to human life means a decisive conversion of consciousness, quite as decisive as the conversion of the vital consciousness of the plant into the mental consciousness of the animal. It is surely impossible that a conversion so decisive made by nature should be reversed by the soul and the decision of the spirit within her come, as it were, to naught. It could only be possible for human souls, supposing such to exist, in whom the conversion was not decisive, souls that had developed far enough to make, occupy, or assume a human body, but not enough to ensure the safety of this assumption, not enough to remain secure in its achievement and faithful to the human type of consciousness. Or at most, there might be, supposing certain animal propensities to be vehement enough to demand a separate satisfaction quite of their own kind, a sort of partial rebirth, a loose holding of an animal form by a human soul with an immediate subsequent reversion to its normal progression. The movement of nature is always sufficiently complex for us not to deny dogmatically such a possibility, and if it be a fact, then there may exist this modicum of truth behind the exaggerated popular belief which assumes an animal rebirth of the soul once lodged in man to be quite as normal and possible as a human reincarnation. But whether the animal reversion is possible or not, the normal law must be the recurrence of birth in new human forms for a soul that has become capable of humanity.
Very interesting paragraph. See how in this entire chapter, Sri Aurobindo has taken up all the various sides of this problem of rebirth, starting with the materialist standpoint, and then taking up successively each one of the religious ideas, including all the various Indian ideas about rebirth that have been half-formed in a sense. This is quite a common misconception in popular Indian sort of thinking that, you know, is related to the whole idea of karma. And he does not take up the issue of karma here at all. He will consider it later in this book, which is, you know, the mechanism of, or related to the mechanism of rebirth. But he takes up the problem, philosophically speaking, that is it possible for the human being or the human soul to assume births which are animal births after arriving at a human body? And since, given the logic of this paragraph, of this chapter itself, the soul's appearance is so intimately related to the appearance of the faculties of nature, because the soul, in a sense, is inhabiting a certain nature depending on its own evolution, it is not reasonable that the soul that has assumed the poise, or evolved to the point of the poise where it will inhabit a human nature body, will go back to an animal nature body. Because, in a sense, soul's evolution is tied to nature's evolution. And such a radical, innovation or, leap, quantum leap of consciousness has occurred in the assumption of the human form by a human soul, that to assume an animal form after that would not stand to reason. But then, as he is making this argument, he is also pointing out that nature is not a rigid mental does not follow mental laws in a rigid fashion, and that there are exceptions that can be devised, or that can express this kind of a reversion from the human to the animal level. And what are these exceptions? He takes them up. One is that there is, one may say, a kind of an insecure transition from animal sort of soul to a human soul. And therefore, it is not sufficiently, one may say, that the psychic being is not sufficiently formed, is not sufficiently secure, is still too unformed, and there's still too much of the psychic vitality and too little of the psychic mentality to it. And if that is the case, then it's possible that it may take one life back to the animal and prepare itself before again resuming the human birth. And again, similarly, he's talking about the instance where the human has a certain, you know, in its emergence out of an animal life, has certain animal propensities that are too strong, and therefore that it might again go back to the animal to have a certain kind of experience and a mastery of a certain degree before reverting back to or returning to the line of human development.
Abhishek. Devashish, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. That kind of reminds me, Madhav Pandit once told me a story about an ashramite who was always taking milk from the kitchen. And people complained about it. Then it reached the mother. And she said, no, you know, she said, don't bother with it because that man in his life, life was my cat. So I guess I could see if he continued, you know, I could see him having another breath as either a cat or a human. Also, I was thinking of like temple elephants. I remember being really taken by an elephant in Madurai. It reminded me that, I mean, there's a lot of stories in India, as you must know, about great gurus or whatever being born as animals for some certain reason.
Continue. Sorry.
No. You go ahead. Go ahead.
That is, of course, another thing, which is that, you know, souls may choose to occupy animal lives or animal bodies at a certain level of development. In other words, it is possible, you know, we have stories of that kind in the Indian tradition where so this is more in the nature of what is called sainthood, in that a certain development of the psychic being can reach a person to a level of freedom where they can choose a nature body that is less complex than the human. So this is a choice of the soul in a sense. Only at a point of development where a soul can make such choices. What one calls saintly souls may often choose simpler. We have the very famous instance in the Upanishads of Jada Bharat, who chose to come as a sort of a, you know, as an imbecile in a human body, but nevertheless sort of apparently mentally deficient, but still spiritually fully developed. So these kind of sort of things that you're talking about, animal lives, etc., are exceptions. Now the other one about the lives just after an animal life, human lives taken on just after an animal life, and certain animal traits being repeated, that is very interesting. And I don't know about the question of being interested in drinking milk, etc., stealing milk, as a trait that is carried on past a kind of a cat life. Such things would really have more to do with the nature than the soul. But it is possible that certain strong, psychic sort of formations attract certain nature traits into a particular life. Anjaliji would probably know that Kirit Joshi was talking about a similar instance of somebody in the school that was causing first gave importance to the development of the psychic being and to the development of the equality. That becomes the basis after which a lot of these forms of inner knowledge can gradually start developing on their own.
So, Debashista, when in the synthesis of yoga, he talks about the four aids.
The guru helps, and the fact that they're not in a body makes little difference to, you know, that inner contact. But at the same time, the essence of it is that the teaching of Sri Aurobindo is not dependent on any particular individual being the guru. It's really a fundamental change of consciousness that relies on the divine as the guru.
You should or you should? No, it's not so.
You know, there's a very interesting part, and I think that this topic that you've raised, Lopa, is a very, very important one, because a lot of sort of religiosity surrounds this whole business about Sri Aurobindo and the mother, and almost there is some kind of a formation in many people's minds that if one is to emerge into the supramental age, everybody has to acknowledge Sri Aurobindo and the mother as the guru. See, that this kind of a formation exists in many people's minds. I want to draw attention to something very interesting that is recorded by Kapali Shastri in the first meeting that he had with Sri Aurobindo. And in that meeting, he had read the Arya, and he had himself been developing his own interpretations of the Vedas. And also he was in contact with Ganapati Muni at that time. And so after his conversation with Sri Aurobindo, when he got up to leave, it seems Sri Aurobindo, he said to Sri Aurobindo, but now how can I practice this? How can I get this truth that you're talking about? And it seems he records that Sri Aurobindo, lifted his hand and pointed above and made a sweeping gesture below and said, you could get it from here, and then he pointed to himself and said, or you could get it from me. And Kapali Shastri says, I would like it from you. And that's how he becomes the disciple of Sri Aurobindo. But this is a very, very important point that he's making there. He's saying that this reality, this truth that Sri Aurobindo has brought, is the divine reality, is the divine truth, and one can get it directly from above, which is how he himself got it. And so that descending power is not something that makes conditions on people. It makes its own sort of self-revelation. And if somebody in the process of that self-revelation recognizes Mother and Sri Aurobindo to be their guru, that is a certain aspect of grace. But if they don't, there are other aspects of grace that may be given to them. This we should realize.
Yeah, thank you, Debashista. That was very nice.
Should I
read
now?
Debashista, I have one more question, but it's a little mundane, so I don't know if you want to take it now.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I was just thinking a little mathematically about these souls. So we just know that the soul principle has matured, and when it is mature enough to take on a human body, it assumes it. So the fact that there are so many humans on Earth, more than what it was before when, let's say, humanity began, can we say anything about the fact that more souls are maturing? And if that is true, then in future, can we expect more humans?
In Now, it's difficult to tell whether there'll be more humans in the future or whether there is a certain kind of, you know, continuous progression. But certainly we could say that there are more souls that are entering into the, you know, that are being pushed into a more evolved condition. I would tend to agree with that. Larger and larger numbers of animal souls are taking human birth. This seems to be the case.
Okay, and on the other side of the spectrum, can we also say there are souls that are moving out of the human births, like gurus who have decided not to take on a human birth anymore?
Well, that is also difficult to tell, Lopa, because you see, you know, the problem seems to be another reason why there are so many human beings could also be that souls are not emerging out of the human condition. That particularly in a predominantly materialistic age, souls are repeating again and again, cycling, you know, in a groove in the human existence. So, regarding the movement out of the human, you know, I don't know how many souls are moving out of the human. And there too, you see, the mother says that at that point where a person actually wants to choose escape out of the human condition, they are often given a choice. And at that point, they 90% of such souls choose to resume the human you know, evolution, be part of the evolution. So that is something which is difficult to say, you know, mm-hmm. what is happening in terms of moving out of the human condition.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that there are theories, the population growth theories about resources being more available, so it could just be a face for the occult need for more bodies, like human bodies or mental bodies.
Yeah, it's possible, but these things are kind of too esoteric to really pass judgment on.
Yeah, and then we don't even know how many years in between, from birth to birth, how many years in between elapse. So how many simultaneous souls, and then it becomes really mundane.
True. Exactly. There's also the fact that, you know, there may be souls, you know, waiting to take birth at a certain point, and taking this particular time juncture as the hour of their reappearance from a long time back.
Of course, those who believe in Leela would not even think it to be good to just move out of the human condition. No, maybe unless after being human you can be a god and continue the Leela.
Yeah, I see. The Leela Vadins, usually in the Vaishnava sense, they actually want to get out of the human condition and live in the supraphysical. That's the supraphysical ideal, where they want to actually find the unveiled Leela of God and, you know, live there. There is, of course, among the Leela Vadins, there is a split. And, you know, one group considers the highest reality to be this, you know, existence outside of the human in an eternal Vaikuntha. And the other one, of course, is the Chaitanya group takes it that all existences given to us or granted to us by the divine are equally good, because they are all, you know, it's sort of only a different form of Leela, but there's no difference in, you know, quality of Leela. I mean, difference in quality of Leela, but there's no difference in degree of Leela, irrespective of where one is, according to that school. Mm-hmm. It's the total surrender school of Vaishnavism.
Uh-huh. And what was the other school? Like, who's the leader of the other school?
Well, most of the other Vaishnava schools, say Vallabhacharya or, you know, Ramanuja, etc., believe in existence in superphysical Vaikuntha world.
Mm-hmm. And how about the Vaishnavism that Sri Aurobindo writes in the Record of Yoga, where there are those five forms, or that Krishna in five forms, yeah. Right? Pradyumna.
Yeah, that is, it's a very old form of Vaishnavism.
Oh, Pancharatra, yeah.
Pancharatra, yeah, Pancharatra. Pancharatra, I'm not sure exactly what is their aim. It is closely related to Tantra, in fact. So I'm not sure what is their aim. Yeah, okay, why don't we go on? Read another.
But why a succession of human births and not one alone? For the same reason that has made the human birth itself a culminating point of the past succession, the previous upward series, it must be so by the very necessity of the spiritual evolution. For the soul has not finished what it has to do by merely developing into humanity. It has still to develop that humanity into its higher possibilities. Obviously, the soul that lodges in a Caribbean or an untaught primitive or an Apache of Paris or an American gangster has not yet exhausted the necessity of human birth, has not developed all its possibilities or the whole meaning of humanity, has not worked out all the sense of Satchidananda in the universal man. Neither has the soul lodged in a vitalistic European occupied with dynamic production and vital pleasure, or in an Asiatic peasant engrossed in the ignorant round of the domestic and economic life. We may reasonably doubt whether even a Plato or a Shankara marks the crown and therefore the end of the outflowering of the spirit in man. We are apt to suppose that these may be the limit, because these and others like them seem to us the highest point which the mind and soul of man can reach. But that may be the illusion of our present possibility. There may be a higher, or at least a larger possibility, which the divine intends yet to realize in man, and if so, it is the steps built by these highest souls which were needed to compose the way up to it and to open the gates. At any rate, this present highest point at least must be reached before we can write finis on the recurrence of the human birth for the individual. Man is there to move from the ignorance and from the little life which he is in his mind and body, to the knowledge and the large divine life which he can compass by the unfolding of the spirit. At least the opening out of the spirit in him, the knowledge of his real self, and the leading of the spiritual life must be attained before he can go definitively and forever other way. There may too be beyond this initial culmination a greater flowering of the spirit in the human life, of which we have as yet only the first intimations. The imperfection of man is not the last word of nature, but his perfection too is not the last peak of the spirit.
So here human beings are being shown to themselves house an entire range of evolutionary possibilities, And of course, we see this as an example of, or an exemplification of Sri Aurobindo's own statement that man is a transitional being. In the human itself, there are ranges of ascent and of integration of lower rungs. And of course, it's a very critical point in the evolution in which the human being finds himself. Because in a way, this extremely uneasy alliance of matter, life, and mind takes a long time and very, very kind of critical stage of bringing to some kind of a self-mastery and integration, self-expression of the spirit. So it stands to reason that humanity, in some special sense, cycles within this particular range for a long time, many, many human births, before it is ready to really express the full possibilities of the human spirit, even just the human spirit, that is what we were talking about, the manu, the psychic being tied to the human instrument as a master of the human nature, you know, a spiritual, master of the human nature needs to actually bring into play a whole range of nature expressions and bring them together, integrate them, before he is capable of actually expressing the fullness of human potentiality. And that is really what the spirit is here to achieve. Not so much to escape out of the human, but to bring to a fulfillment the nature possibilities of the human before moving to anything else, anything greater. So there Sri Aurobindo draws attention to a number of these stages or ranges. And you know, in modern times, it has been one of the sort of misunderstandings of Sri Aurobindo's writings to look at passages like this and say that, you know, he has actually tried to typify certain types of human beings, in terms of races and ethnicities. Like he talks about, you know, I checked that Apache of Paris out. That's an interesting phrase because one usually associates the Apache with an American Indian or Native American tribe. But the Apache of Paris is a kind of gangster. You know, there's a sort of a whole subculture, a gangster subculture, and even a kind of a subculture of expression. It's almost like a precursor to rap. Sort of gangster dance in Paris in the 19th century and early 20th century. There was a whole subculture called the Apache subculture, and he's referring to that, which must have been an extremely contemporary reference at his time, almost like if we were to refer to gangster rap today. But he's talking about that, but the Caribbean is also a very interesting phrase or term there. He's talking about aboriginals of the Caribbean. And this term came into prominence in English writing. You find it in Shakespearean writing and then continues for a while, for example, connected with the 12th night and things of that nature. We find this notion of aboriginals of the Caribbean. He is pointing to the fact that a certain kind of unrefined vital existence and aboriginal existence, is the nature attribute of these beings that needs further refinement and also to be transcendent and integrated with higher human expressions. But then he goes on to talk about others, and even how, what we think of as more sort of civilized formations as the vitalistic European, occupied with dynamic production and vital pleasure, or with the Asiatic peasant, and you know, we think of village life as something which is extremely idealized, and in some sense, you know, that there are various kind of people who thought of India as being idealized by the eternal village. So he's pointing to the fact that these kind of ideals also are extremely limited in terms of the gamut of human experience and expression. And then he goes on to even talk about the wisdom of Plato or Shankara, point to the fact that there too, you know, we have some height reached, but that height may hardly be called the final resting place of the human soul in its development of, you know, its nature expression. And that's how he points to the fact that the evolution continues, in a sense, that the evolution of the human being, the human soul, in its attempt to develop the various nature possibilities and integrate them into a fullness, has not completed itself. Today, and it proceeds through ages, today we are in a largely materialistic age all over the world, and maybe it's a way by which certain, sort of nature possibilities are being made universal, that all of us can have as our common possession the soul mastery over certain aspects of nature. But beyond that, we must arise at also universal work, higher expression of the philosophical being and finally the spiritual being. And that is yet to come. That is what he's talking about. There may too be beyond initial culmination a greater flowering of the spirit in the human life, of which we have as yet only the first intimations. And then he points to the fact that that too is not going to sort of end the evolution of the soul. The imperfection of man is not the last word of nature, but his perfection too is not the last peak of the spirit. The soul will move on into other nature expressions that are more sort of, you know, native to its own divinity.
Debashita, can you tell about the Greek ideal? Shyabinda also quotes it. Is it the intellectual development that they thought to be the perfect human?
Well, the Greek ideal was the ideal of the integration of mind and body and the restraint of the vital to express the mind in a healthy body. So they believed in temperance of vital life, and this I'm talking about the Hellenic ideal, by the way. So which is what Sri Aurobindo talks about. These are, and the mind would be moved towards the ideals of truth, beauty, justice, goodness, things of that nature, would be a seeker of these and would be wanting to embody these in its life and organize its environment through these principles. And at the same time, it would do this in a kind of a healthy body, a body, a fit body. So as they say, a sound mind in a sound body is the Greek ideal. And it would do this by a restrained vital life. So not an ascetic vital life, nor a hedonistic vital life, but a restrained vital life. But this Hellenic ideal, of course, got then sort of splintered into other kinds of things. And you did have a whole sort of philosophy of vital intelligence, which came as a repercussion to this. And on the other hand, you have the idea of ethics, which was a imposition by the state on the human being and through laws of conduct, which became also very, very much more pronounced in the Roman ideal. So these are the deformations of this Greek ideal, because ultimately the Greek ideal could not offer the fulfillment that the soul needed. Again, we come back to the whole notion of the prioritization of the mind over the vital and the body. Though they're talking of a certain kind of a harmony between mind, vital, and body, this is a compromised harmony. This is not a spiritual harmony, not a native harmony of the self-expression of soul. And that's the reason why it cannot or could not, you know, persist in the history of mankind.
I mean, Debashita, when we say it could not persist, what does that mean? Because even now in modern age, let's say Ayn Rand's objectivism, it looks like she's just reviving that kind of Hellenistic ideal. Right? What do you think?
Yeah, there is a revival of Hellenistic ideal that is present in a number of thinkers. Even actually, Ayn Rand gets her philosophy out of Nietzsche. And Nietzsche's Superman is not that sort of vitalistic blonde beast that people think of. Actually, it is closer to the Greek Hellenic ideal. Except that the part where Nietzsche's Superman sort of, you know, becomes a little dangerous is that he believes in not submitting to what he calls the tyranny of the mediocre. So the hero is somebody who leads a restrained life, who leads a creative life, a life of aesthetic harmony, of beauty, a life which approximates that of the Greek gods, but at the same time, he uses power to dominate the mediocre, the sort of common folk who would otherwise bring him down and destroy his possibilities. This is, in a sense, the Nietzschean sort of, you know, Superman. But, you know, in terms of not being able to persist, what I mean is, in reality, empirically speaking, this ideal has had its day. It makes its appearance in philosophers' books here and there, but it does not get the approval of the time spirit, not being able to create another age as it created in the Hellenic period, because in that period it was given its possibility of self-exploration. The spirit took it as a poise. The soul took it as a poise of self-expression, but now it seeks other poises.
I see.
Debashishta, in Ayn Rand also, one thing that strikes is the lack of love as a force. When one's talking about mediocrity, there's a sense of the other.
Yep. Yes,
hello,
exactly.
Can you hear
and
me?
That's exactly.
Yeah.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Hello. Yeah. I can.
Hello.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, that's really what I was saying, which is that Ayn Rand gets her philosophy of the genius from Nietzsche ultimately. Her Hellenism is also a Nietzschean Hellenism. And so, really, what it lacks, as you're pointing out, is the compassion or the sense of identity or the sense of you know, of oneness, which your being can actually understand the mediocre. The tyranny of the is a danger. There's no doubt about it. And that's, you know, for Nietzsche and Ayn Rand to point that out is certainly a step in the right direction. But at the same time, if it becomes a kind of a reverse tyranny of the hero on the people, then we have a war in our hands. It is only if the higher person can find a principle of harmony or a principle of education whereby the mediocre can be helped to develop their own possibilities. And this kind of a distinction is not created between some beings who are fit to be the gods and some beings who are doomed to remain mediocre. Then only can we really see some sort of goal towards which all of humanity can tend as a species.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you.
In fact, at one end, at some point, it sounds like, at least Ayn Rand's writings, that it sounds like she thrives on the fact that there are mediocres and there are a few powerful beings who need to crush these. So, like, her world order would collapse if there were no mediocres. I mean, that's what I'm just saying, that the lack of love.
Yeah. Can you comment a little about Brahminical society? To an extent, before post Shankara and pre Ramanuja period, there was more of a holding back from knowledge and these type of things in the society, even in India. And how is that? How do you correlate that with this idea of Nietzsche, where it's a kind of a tyranny, right?
Yeah, you mean the tyranny of the wise, the tyranny of those who would keep their knowledge to themselves,
yes,
and not share it with others.
Right.
You're very right. I mean, this has happened throughout time, that there are these periods where you find that there has been some attempt to define human superiority in terms of one faculty or the other. And whether it is the faculty of arts and aesthetics or creativity, or the faculty of wisdom and knowledge, or the faculty of learning, scholasticism, this has happened. But this is again exactly where the time spirit has not allowed it to persist. That's the reason why, Shriya talks about the ages of barbarism that intervene between ages of civilization. Civilized ages reach a certain peak, but evidently that peak is not sufficiently cognizant of the animal nature, which needs to be integrated more perfectly into the higher. And so we have these interventions where these huge edifices collapse because they haven't found the perfect poise of the human psychic being as a nature expression. And we are still seeking for that. It's only when our goal becomes an emergence of the psychic being in its fullness as an integrating power. And that's why the teaching of Sri Aurobindo, in a sense, is so fulfilling, because he points to those four poises, the four aspects which are related to the four forms of the Divine Mother that are the nature aspects of the psychic being, the psychic mentality, the psychic vitality, or psychic physicality, express themselves through these four major modalities of Maheshwari, Mahakali, Mahalakshmi, and Mahasaraswati. And it is only when in all these ways the psychic can psychicize the nature expressions that we can some kind of a fulfilled humanity. See, so that's why every time, as you're pointing out, there is a certain one side development and of some kind, which is, you know, whether the idea of democracy of the proletariat, the bourgeois, or the priesthood, at some point there is a kind of a lopsided development of the nature, which does not see the integral emergence of the psychic existence. That's why coming to the front of the psychic being in the individual and ultimately in collectives is the only real solution to a kind of fulfilled human existence.
You can say Devashish.
Oops. Yes, Vince, can you repeat that? Come again. Hello, Vince. I couldn't hear you. Can you repeat what you were saying?
Can you hear me now? Devashish?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. I was wondering, there's like a progression. I mean, it went from, I don't know who it started with, but you can see a progression in these different philosophers and philosophies, like the Buddha reacted against Brahmanism, and what Martin Luther reacted against a certain rigid type of Christianity. There's lots of different people in India that have like philosophized about different states of being, but the most complete way to me, I think it does seem to be the, I'm a little bit biased, but the Sri Aurobindo philosophy, I mean, in perspective, it seems to have taken what's gone before it in like projected it into the next stage of development with the psychic being behind the development of the different parts of personality. I mean,
yeah, no doubt, because it is a teaching of integrality. It is, you know, it does give a perspective, and actually the thing is, it's not so much a question of, you know, bias, but it's really a question of solving the problem of harmony. You see, really, as he says in the Life Divine, all problems of existence are problems of harmony. And we find that this is the major problem throughout the history of humankind. There have been a variety of ideals that have been proposed as the superior ideal. You see, but how are we to arrive at something which is harmonious, something which is integral? This has escaped us. You see, so an adequate solution to this is naturally what we really seek.
Can I ask you a question, Devashishi?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so on another level, it's just that it's a very simple, we've always been taught as children that Saraswati was the goddess of wisdom. But when Sri Aurobindo names Maheshwari, he calls her the goddess of wisdom, and Saraswati is the goddess of perfection, all the detailed perfection. So why is there this huge difference in the explanation of Mahasaraswati?
Well, you know, you find that Saraswati is subsidiary form of Mahasaraswati. And when we talk about wisdom, we are actually talking, you know, in a very loose way about learning and scholasticism and things like that. We talk about inspiration when we talk about Saraswati. Saraswati originally is a Vedic goddess. And as a Vedic goddess, she's the goddess of inspiration. She brings the higher truth into our minds in the form of word, of the word, divine word. Now, also, she is related to the goddesses of intuition, of discrimination, of other kinds of powers by which we can make a bridge between the mind, between mentality and supramentality. See, she is one of the goddesses who intervenes between the supramentality and the human mentality. See, now, by the time we come to the notion of Mahasaraswati and of Saraswati in the popular parlance, and you think of her as the wisdom, and when you try to relate it to Sri Aurobindo's notion of Mahasaraswati, really what is happening is she is the goddess of wisdom, but this is wisdom as skills. You see, wisdom has many forms. You see, wisdom, I mean, actually, you can see that in the Upanishads, there are various forms of knowledge. And what we call knowledge by identity is one form of knowledge. Knowledge of perception is one form of knowledge. Knowledge of understanding is one form of knowledge. And knowledge of action is one form of knowledge. Knowledge of emotion is another form of knowledge. These are all forms of knowledge. Now, there is a certain kind of form of knowledge which is intrinsic to time, and that is knowledge as action. You see, when we talk about inspired action, there is a knowledge at work. If you think about it, when an artist creates, they may conceive of something, but when they actually start creating, a certain kind of knowledge starts acting through them. And that knowledge works itself out sometimes very differently from what they thought of. So what is it that actually acted? It is a dynamic knowledge, a knowledge as skill, knowledge as, you know, as kaushala. So this is where, you know, the Gita's injunction, yoga karmasu kaushalam, comes in. And that kind of knowledge, knowledge as skill, knowledge as works, is Mahasaraswati's, and that is the kind of knowledge, when we talk about wisdom of Saraswati, that is the kind of knowledge that she can give us. Knowledge as skill, knowledge as action, or in action.
So it's actually knowledge that has translated itself into the manifestation, into action, as you said. It's not just a scholastic capability,
yeah,
of Mahasaraswati.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Saraswati's, you know, boon of knowledge is the knowledge that exists in skill. And it's very true and very interesting, because sometimes we, you know, this is the beauty of the manifestation, that, you know, the knowledge of understanding and the knowledge of identity, the knowledge of perception, which belongs to Maheshwari, for example, can remain outside of time, or can mobilize itself in a very essential way through vast, you know, periods of time without becoming actualized. But knowledge of Mahasaraswati is something that expresses itself in time. And so you are yourself surprised by her knowledge. She is the intuition in action. While acting, we surprise ourselves sometimes due to the knowledge that is expressed, which we didn't even have when we started. And that is the knowledge of Mahasaraswati.
Then what would be the role of Maheshwari?
Role of Maheshwari is to give us a plan, is to give us a blueprint, to give us a large view of things. So within that, the other goddesses can work out their special powers.
Just want to add one small thing. From Devi Bhagavatam, it is Mahalakshmi who kills Mahasaraswati, and Mahasaraswati is the one who kills Shumbha and Nishumbha. Many a times in Shakti Puranas, Mahasaraswati is described as warrior rather than the goddess of wisdom, she is often described as the warrior who kills the asuras. It is slightly different image, but that's what you see in a lot of Shakti books like Lalita Rahasyam and Devi Bhagavatam. That's how you see Mahasaraswati as.
Well, Shyabinda says that asuras are in the mind, right? They are the obstacles of the mind. So one can say that Saraswati is killing the obstacles of the mind. So she is the bringer of knowledge, or puts knowledge into action by killing the asuras of the mind.
Yeah, you can certainly look at it like that.
Shall we end with the meditation, Devashish?
Yeah, let's.